Welcome, everybody. I'm Richard Krause. Glad you can spend part of your day with us. A little bit later on, we're going to meet a fascinating guy. It's Jake Clemens. Now, the last name will probably sound familiar if you're an E Street fan. He took over for his uncle, Clarence Clemens, the big man, in the E Street Band after his uncle's passing. He is a solo artist in his own right. He is on the new Bruce Springsteen album, and he is here to share some stories about the legacy of his uncle. That's later on in the show. First up, though, we meet Alan Doyle from Great Big Sea. He's not just from Great Big Sea, though. He's also an author and has a new book called All Together Now. And he says that he spent his days wishing we could all be together in the early days of the pandemic. So he wrote these stories because they were stories that he would tell if he was at the pub with his friends. We talked about a lot of things, but the interview started when I showed him a copy of the book that I had that he had never seen.
You're holding the first sort of printed version of it that I had ever seen.
Oh, really?
Wow. Awesome. Yeah, I've never seen it.
Well, it looks great.
It was done in such a hurry, right? Like, I mean, not to jump ahead, but the whole story of it is that I was working on this other book, right? And I guess I'm still working on this other book that was really about, you know, connecting the current version or the understood reality of Newfoundland and Labrador and how it connected to the old world, you know? So it was really a travel book and will still hopefully be a travel book about, you know, me trying to find origins and comparisons and the like back to where most of Newfoundland immigrated from, where the bulk of the population over the, you know, came from. And of course, when that all became obviously impossible to do, I just figured we'd put it on hold. But the folks at Penguin Random House said, look, do you have an appetite to do a short story book or something that you could do in a hurry that people might enjoy having for Christmas? Now, this was in like May, you know. I was like, no one would I know about writing books. I was like, it's already May. And they're like, yeah, we know, but do you think you could give it, if we gave you a month, could you write a book? And I was like, well, let's give it a go. So what I did was it's really a collection of some of the fun stories that I've been telling over the years about real experiences and stuff that I had in my adult life and in my young life growing up in Petty Harbor that, you know, you might tell if we were sat around the best night at the Duke here in St. John's with all my gang, you know, who are constantly fighting to get their stories in, you know, one over the other. And that's my favorite kind of night out anyway, you know.
Yeah.
And as I'm sure you won't be surprised, it's quite common here in Newfoundland to have to fight to get your story in because someone else got a good one. I guarantee you that.
You talk in the book that St. John's has one of the few great pub cultures in North America. How important is pub culture to the city?
In St. John's, it's really a gathering place. And again, like, as I mentioned in the book, there might be a possible and popular misconception that pub culture is a Newfoundland thing. Right. And but it isn't, of course. Like, rural Newfoundland towns have legions and dance halls and stuff. They don't have a pub culture the way that St. John's does. And it's one of the things that makes it kind of like a city state here on the island. Yeah. And then it's way more akin to a Southern Irish or Southern English kind of setup more than it would be like even a Nova Scotian or Atlantic Canadian setup. So the pub culture here is very important in historical terms because, of course, St. John's, as you know, was built with these small, connected, tiny houses crawling up the hills all over the place. Yeah. People didn't have room for big gatherings in their houses in the city of St. John's, so they gathered publicly. And, of course, that's the heart and soul of the pub culture. And what they did when they got together, you know, in pubs is talk a lot. And they still do, thankfully.
Well, you talk about the book as being a virtual pub, a virtual Newfoundland pub. So set the scene for me a little bit. If I go to a pub there, there's stories, there's beer. What's going on? What kind of night out am I looking at?
really and truly, first of all, I will describe it to you as best I can, but this I vow to you, sir, we will do it one day.
Absolutely. And,
as I sit in the shadow of my mom's picture, I will tell you right now that we'll have a night at the Duke.
And,
the Duke is just one of many great pubs in St. John's, and it's one of my favorite ones. And because it's what would happen if you were with me on a perfect day, we'd roll in there on a Thursday, which is my favorite night to go out. Because as I say, Richard, you know who goes out on the weekends? Everybody.
Yep.
You know who goes out on Thursday? People who just can't wait. And we would go to the Duke and we'd sit around happy hour time, and which ideally get the corner seat against the, with which is a, there's a high table at the Duke that if you get in there, your right arm is on the table and your left arm is on the bar and your back is to the wall and you can see everything. And you can see behind the bar, you can see down back, and it's like, and then slowly but surely, or quickly but surely, on a Friday or a Thursday in St. John's, it fills up. And you're in the, what I love about Newfoundland pubs, and Irish pubs, and English pubs too, for that matter, is that up until very recent times, there's no assigned seating necessarily. Like, you go into the pub to be with everybody in the pub, not with the group you came with, you know, like. And when I went to the mainland for the first time in the early 90s with Great Big Sea, it was one of the things that kind of surprised me. Like I went into a sports bar for the first time in my life. Never even heard of one, you know. Like, and you go in and it's like, it's supposed to be a pub, if you will. But you go in and someone shows you to your table. I'm like, I don't want to go to a table. Like, you know, like. I want to go to a table and stay home.
You're listening to my interview with Alan Doyle, author of All Together Now, A Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times.
The cast of people that would be around me and you at the Duke over the next 4 or 5 hours would be constantly changing. And as we would be in St. John's, and all my friends, as I like to say, are crazy, it would be a wonderful gathering of people who would offer a song or a story or a joke, or no matter what you said, they would have something to say right after. There's nothing going to stop the conversation, I'm telling you right now. And then, of course, it's also this thing where I think there's a joy in just gathering, right? And that we, you know, like I said, it's our superpower. You know, as long as we can get together, we can do anything, you know? And it would be a wonderful night out, and it would be a great, it remains one of my favorite things to do.
And the book is reflective of that. So the book is this virtual pub, and the stories, the short stories that are in here, range from everything from meeting Jeff Healy for the first time to how Russell Crowe starts a phone conversation, like you've just been talking 30 seconds before, everything growing up in Petty Harbor, drinking beer with the old fishermen that would, you know, if you worked hard, you got a beer, even if you were, you know, 14 years old. And so
that's right.
The stories really cover a lot of ground. How did you choose which ones to put in?
In all honesty, I started, because the book was done so quickly, yeah. I just started and went like, okay, I'll tell that one. And then, And then I waited for someone to tell me I had enough. And then it was literally that kind of quickly done. But then in sort of after we had the first flurry of stuff submitted, I did do a little check and chatting with Tim, who is the editor at Penguin Random House. I just said, look, have we covered enough basis? You know, like, is there, I would love for it to be an equal reflection of my young life, you know, my professional life and my home life currently, you know, like I would love to be able to just paint a picture of, because truth be told, in that seat at the Duke, we talk about all that stuff, right. You know, and some of it would be lovely. And some of it would be debaucherous, and some of it would be funny, and some of it would be, you know, meaningful and thoughtful. And that's just what makes for a great night out.
And does your meeting with Jeff Healy still haunt you?
The first meeting with Jeff, yeah. Really, my only meeting with Jeff, really, was in the backstage in Central Park in New York City. And I always wanted to have that second conversation with him, but I never got to have it. Sadly, he was amazing.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
an incredible day that day in New York City because we opened for Great Big Sea, opened for Jeff Healey and Tragically Hip at a big Canada Day celebration on July 1st. And that night, I didn't mention it in the story, but that night, out of the blue, somebody handed me and Daryl Power two tickets to go to what was supposed to be the last ever Bruce Springsteen and E Street Band concert at Madison Square Garden.
Oh.
And we left and we went to Bruce Springsteen at Madison Square Garden that night. And then we left that and went to CBGB's and watched Sarah Harmer.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was amazing. It was just one of those days like, this is an incredible day. And yeah. But the whole Jeff Healey story really is, other than being like a really awkward and funny brush with celebrity long before we knew how to handle any of it. And it to show kind of how unworldly we were, you know, even though we were put in these very worldly situations, just like any young person from a small place, I guess. But also, it was just like meant really to be one of the stories in the book that are part of my lucky life, right? Where I've just happened to have these good, bad, and indifferent, and all, well, not bad, but good and awkward and weird, and but really human interactions with some of the most famous people in my young life, you know, like where a handshake here, or like, you know, as my buddy Perry said, Alan, you laid your hands on the Grey Cup and Anne Murray in the same day. It's, how do you do much better than that?
These are stories that I, you know, that you tell at the pub. These are stories that are around. Did it give you a new perspective on any of the stories now that you're writing them down? Telling them and writing them down are two different things.
Yeah. Some of them are extremely difficult to write down. And some of them are very easy. Like recounting a tale of what my uncle was like when I was a kid wasn't very hard to write down because it's all kind of hindsight. And, you know, you have that perspective that where you, it's kind of like a fairy tale anyway. And so you can, writing it is not that difficult. I tell you one thing, if I have learned one thing after this book, it confirms for me what I've long suspected, and is that I've had, even at this stage, you know, I just turned 51, like I've had one of the luckiest lives I've ever even heard of. Like, and I don't say that to be like in any way immodest or whatever. It's my God. Like, it's just like all that happened to me. Like, and it's just like, that's enough for 10 lifetimes already, you know? And it's just, man, oh man. I if there's a luckier fella out there than me, I'd love to meet him. I'll tell you.
Tell me a little bit about what it's like being in isolation. You've been home for 8-9 months, whatever it's been, and that's different. That's probably the longest time you've been in one place in a very long time.
It's the longest time that I've been in one place since 1992, and it's the longest time I've gone without a live performance of some kind since I was 11. So that'd be 1980. So it's been a very, very strange time. And I'd be lying if I didn't tell you there wasn't many dark moments in the last, you know, block of time where I just like really, really, really had to struggle with staying optimistic and staying positive and staying forward looking, you know. But we managed it, and the book helped, you know, to be honest with you, it helped me. That's why I hope it helps other people too. And helped me stay connected, you know, with, you know, people who like what I do for a living, you know, and I had no idea. I thought I did, but I had no idea how much I, appreciate, you know, the life that's been afforded me by people who will come see me sing songs, right, or read a book or act in a movie or a play or whatever. And I, you know, if there was ever a blink of me not fully appreciating that, it'll never happen again. I'll tell you right now. Because, you know, as I say, it's a lucky life, and it hurts when it gets taken away, I'll tell you.
You're listening to my interview with Alan Doyle, author of All Together Now, A Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times. Well, I always think that when I talk to people who, like myself, have been inside for a very long time now, that if we don't learn something after all of this, then it's wasted. We've wasted our time. We have to take something away from this. We have to learn something. Otherwise, it's all been for nothing.
Well, for me, it came in waves because, you know, we played a gig as per normal on March 8th in Vancouver. March 9th, we all flew out of Vancouver. I came back to St. John's and I was to have 9 days at home while our trucks and buses all rolled from Vancouver to Mississauga, I believe. And we were to fly back on the 18th, I think, of March, 17th or 18th of March or something, and start our second of five legs in the, in, and then we never, ever, ever got out. We never went back. And so then the first two or three months, say March and April and May, were very difficult because we were constantly trying to deny that this was possible. We're not shutting down a whole tour.
Yeah.
Like every stage in the world is not going dark at the same time, guys. It's like, yes, it is. Yeah. And it's just like, well, what are we going to do? Send the buses back to the parking lot with our equipment in them? Yes. And they still are. There's two buses parked in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island with my knapsack in it. And I swear to God. And like, it's, it was, so that was a shocking time. And like, and so it took a couple of months for me, I think, to catch my breath almost. And then luckily the spring came around. And then the summer really in Newfoundland, and you know, was, I'd be lying if it wasn't a very joyous time. It was, we felt that it, like we were, you know, our numbers for COVID and stuff were so small. And so that we felt, you know, with any reasonable measure of adherence to public health guidelines, we'd be fine living almost normally while we're here. And it afforded me really a summer at home for the first time since I was 21 or something, you know. So it's there's blessings in it, no doubt about it.
I wonder for you, if there's a show when you think of live music, either that you performed in or that you went to see, that comes to mind.
Well, both. I mean, like every day, one of the weird things I've been doing, Richard, to be honest with you, is that I've kind of flipped my days around. In the winter, when the tour stopped, the night times hurt more than the day. And I did not want to be awake. I said, I nothing I want to do in the nighttime is available to me. So I'm just going to bed. Right. And I started going to bed and getting up like 5:30 in the morning, which is very, not like a musician's schedule, this musician anyway. So yeah. And then it hurt too much to think about the night in, you know, two nights at the Danforth sold out that we weren't getting, and, you know, two nights in Montreal sold out, and three nights in Nova Scotia sold out that we weren't doing, you know, all that just stung so much that I tried not to think about it.
We continue the conversation with Alan Doyle, author of All Together Now. He's also the singer and multi-instrumentalist of Great Big Sea. And here he talks about getting ready to go back on the road again after laying off for the pandemic.
It's funny getting ready now to go back out on the road. I'm like, man, how many songs do I know how to sing? I don't even but yeah, you're right. I mean, it's just, we were to have a beautiful night playing with Blue Rodeo in August at the, well, I guess it's not called the Molson Amphitheater anymore now. It's Bud Stage, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I remember the first time Great Big Sea opened for Blue Rodeo at the old Memorial Stadium in St. John's in 1995. Wow. And it was like meeting Superman and Batman, you know, coming. It was just like, and it was just an incredible thing. And so to still be in that company is a real thrill. And I look forward to getting back to that. And then, yeah. And I mean, just, you know, for me, I've had as much a thrill sometimes discovering somebody I knew nothing about. Mm. You know, you wander into a bar after a gig somewhere on the road and you go like, who's, and there's some cover band playing or whatever. And, you know, it's fine. And then you go like, after five songs, you're like, Who is the piano player in this band? My God, like, you know, that kind of thing. That can, all that stuff only comes from a life on the road, right? Where you're just seeing a new town, a new thing, and you're like, who is that singing like Bon Jovi covers right now? They're amazing, you know. Like, and that, I love that discovery too, and I miss it.
You wrote the book during this time, and it's your third book, so you know, yeah, I assume that you spend time writing, but in a general course of your work life, have you been writing songs?
Oh yeah, getting ready to do this folk record now with I'm gonna spend some time with Joel Plaskett over in Nova Scotia when I go over next week, and we're going to work on some of those songs that I wrote. But I've been writing a lot for this musical production that we've been working on for the Charlottetown Festival for the summer season of 2022. That's been a real trip because, I don't know very much about musical theater, you know, and it's been great to work with people who do.
You're listening to my interview with Alan Doyle, author of All Together Now, A Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times.
This book was weird for the writing of it in that it's the first of the three books that I wrote that I did here. Like the first two books, I don't think I wrote 10 paragraphs in this house.
Right.
I always wrote it on the road, right? That's my road therapy. You know, like I finish sound check and I have 6 hours before the show and I need to do something productive that's quiet and creative, and writing just works perfect for that, you know? But this one, of course, I wrote here. I wrote almost all of it right behind me. Yeah. I sat at this, you know, my little home studio here, and I would write a story and then work on a song and then just try to really and truly try to creatively occupy myself. And so I'm grateful. I'm really grateful in retrospect that the Penguin Random House gang got after me and had enough faith in me to do it, to be honest with you, because it wasn't, I understand from the book writing world, that's a pretty short turnaround time. I used to joke, I said, my God, everything else I work on in my life takes, you know, a week and a half,
yeah,
max, you know, mostly a day. And it's like, you're writing a book and like 7 months into it, you're like, are we still working on the same thing we were working on in September? Like, are we filming Ben-Hur here today or something? Like
that was my interview with Alan Doyle. He is always so much fun to talk to. Check out his book, All Together Now, A Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times. And you can find that book wherever you buy fine books. My next guest is an accomplished solo artist who has played saxophone with everyone from Eddie Vedder and Roger Waters to The Swell Season and The Roots. Since 2012, Jake Clemens has been the saxophonist for Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band after the passing of the band's original saxophone player, his uncle, Clarence Clemens. In this interview, we talk about life, legacy, and the E Street Band. Here's Jake Clemens. Your uncle was Clarence Clemens, sax player for the E Street Band, but growing up, you weren't allowed to listen to his music in the house. Why was that?
My father came from a very, very staunch Southern Baptist background, so we didn't listen to rock and roll, and we didn't have it in the house. My father was the Marine Corps band director, so we had lots of marching band music, classical music, and gospel, and that was it.
And he played music, obviously. Was the whole family musical?
Yeah. I often say that music was like the first language that we learned at home. We'd often gather around the piano and my dad would play, and constantly being played in the house. So the whole family grew up with music as part of our code.
Right. Now, how old were you then when you started listening to music that your father wouldn't have approved of?
I guess I was pretty young when I first heard, we went and saw E Street when I was 8 years old. That would have been the first time I heard, electric guitars. And then shortly thereafter, when I found myself in the house by myself, I would click on Channel 22, which was MTV, right, where I lived at the time. And just for a few minutes, just to get a little snippet of what was out there. And, but I was, I guess, around 12 or 13 when I finally started to actually invest in different kinds of music that I wasn't allowed to listen to.
You're listening to my interview with E Street Band saxophone player Jake Clemens. And when you say that's when you saw the E Street Band when you were 8 was the first time you had heard electric guitars, what did you think? I mean, was it mind-blowing to you to see not only your uncle playing up there, but to hear the whole thing put together? It must have been something.
Yeah, it was a really dynamic experience. To be honest with you, I don't remember a ton about the music itself just because it was so loud. Right. And again, I'd never heard distortion before. So you know, I just remember it being very loud. I remember seeing there was a horn section on that tour, which I thought was really interesting and cool. The thing that grabbed me the most was just that everybody in the room was in the same moment. Somehow they all seemed to live in the same breath and lean into the same moment, and the band included. You know, the most fascinating part about watching my uncle was, like, he'd always just been my uncle. I knew that his music was on the radio, but to hear this huge, long introduction about, you know, him being, like, the master of the universe and the next king of England and master of disaster, you know, all these crazy things. And then to feel, like, the eruption from the crowd when, you know, at the end of his introduction. That was just kind of, like, you know, left me awestruck. And that was... In one of my more vain moments, that was the impetus for me to pick up the saxophone.
Well, you talk about the band playing, and they were just all so present and together in the moment. And I always think you can tell when you're watching a band where it seems like they're sharing a brain, you know, where everyone is just kind of on the same wavelength in such a interconnected way that it doesn't sound like anything else. And that I've had that feeling when I've seen the E Street Band perform, and lots of, I think the Talking Heads felt that way to me.
Nice.
Lots of other bands. Do you get that feeling when you're playing with your solo band or with the E Street Band? Does it feel communal or like the Borg, like you're all connected somehow?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's without question the goal every night. And then to take it a step further, for that sense to go beyond the stage and to feel like the audience is as connected as the band is in that moment. I mean, that's everything for me. That is the goal every night. That is what I live off of when I'm on tour. That sense of everyone being plugged in, everyone being dialed in. And we're all listening to each other. We're all feeling each other beyond the stage. I mean, like, to the furthest reaches of the room. Every person in that room is important.
You were 11 or 12 when you first performed with your uncle in church. What did you learn from him?
You know, the biggest things that I learned from Clarence in terms of my playing were to make each note important. You know, there are some people that talk a lot and use a lot of words. And there's some people who say very few words, but those few words are powerful and deep and meaningful. And he played that way and encouraged me to listen and to be a part of the sound, because that would be, it would be more significant and more meaningful that way. And that was one of the biggest lessons in terms of playing I got from him.
You started on piano and then moved to saxophone. Is there a difference between how you think as a musician when you're playing piano versus when you're playing saxophone?
Without question, absolutely. Whether it's guitar or saxophone or drums, like, there's a different space in my head for each instrument. I sometimes wonder if that's good or not. and I'm always... I don't know, I shouldn't say always, but I'm often, like, trying to, like, cross that threshold and get into my other brain when I'm playing a different instrument. I mean, each instrument has its own personality and its own characteristics and translates differently.
Is there one that you feel more comfortable with improvising on? I think I read where you'd said that the saxophone allows you slightly more freedom when you're playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I without question, think the least when I'm playing saxophone. You know, I don't know if that's a thing that's part of my DNA or my soul, or if it's just a matter of, like, I've spent the most time in my life playing that instrument. But yeah, I mean, absolutely, there's I can listen easier on a saxophone and just enjoy the experience without thinking versus guitar or piano. I mean, you know, writing is a whole different story, but in terms of, like, improvising or just being a part of the sound, it comes easy, so I'm successful.
When you took over for your uncle as the sax player in the E Street Band, did part of you think that the shoes were just too big to fill, that there might have been a sense that maybe I just can't handle this?
Well, I guess I'll start to answer that question by saying that I from day one I've always felt like I'm filling in for Clarence. I don't feel like I've taken over for him or replaced him by any measure. You know, it's a matter of extending his voice a little longer in that role. You know, Clarence has said to me for years before he passed that he wanted me to step in for him eventually. And, you know, his last couple of tours, I was on the road with him a lot because he just wanted me to be there in case he didn't feel up to it, which was a psychotic idea because he was always, you know, he loved that more than anything. And I'd seen him go through surgery after surgery and be put back together again. So the thought of him not being there wasn't realistic to me anyway.
What was it like when he said to you that he would like you to take over for him? I mean, that's a pretty heavy thing to have happen. It's not just uncle to nephew. This is uncle to nephew, legendary musician to musician, about joining one of the biggest bands in the world. I mean, it must have made your head spin a little bit.
To be completely honest with you, I didn't really give much thought to it.
Really?
Him saying that to me, it was like it was like Santa Claus saying that you're gonna take over the reindeer one day. Like, Santa Claus doesn't go away, you know? I mean, Clarence was that kind of a figure for me. He was a brother and a father and a friend and all these different, you know, connections. But also connections that seemed eternal, you know, like he was gonna be around at least as long as I was. So whenever he mentioned that, it was kind of like, I really appreciate, you know, the consideration and the, you know, that thought. But you know, it's I would always have to remind him that you know, he was like the $6 billion man, you know, like he was never gonna fall apart. Like, they were always gonna be able to put him back together again, and he'd be able to do this as long as he wanted to.
Can you talk a little bit about the balance of playing in one of the biggest bands in the world while also writing and performing your own music and releasing CDs and that kind of thing? How do you find that balance?
Sometimes it's harder than others. You know, there's certainly, I mean, I guess to start with, like, I honestly consider myself like the luckiest musician and songwriter maybe ever, you know. I mean, like, just to be able to be groomed by a band like this for most of my life, really, especially now, and to be able to learn from, you know, these masters is just an incredible gift. And then to be able to take that and apply it to my own experience, you know, being 30 years younger than these guys means I have a long road ahead of me. So to be able to take what I can from them now in such a serious and like intense educational platform is surreal, you know. I'm really grateful for that.
You're listening to my interview with Jake Clements, the saxophone player from Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band. Well, once you started playing to these massive audiences and seeing how certain songs connected and how others maybe didn't, did that influence your own writing at all?
There's something about an E Street show that transcends the group, you know, even the legendary writing that Bruce has done. There's something that transcends it. The music doesn't fail in those shows, but it's because of what's being given and the openness for the audience to receive it. So, you know, there aren't moments where I watch and go, you know, like, oh, that song didn't work. Because that moment is so true and certain every night. I've definitely learned a lot from speaking to them about you know, their writing processes and their experiences, and then being able to apply, you know, those lessons to my own songwriting. And then just like, you know, the gift of being able to like sit down with Bruce with some new songs that I have and just get some feedback on how he felt about them, you know, it's been tremendous. So yeah, I mean, it's pretty special.
Your 2017 solo album, Fear and Love, I thought was introspective. It's personal. The last one, though, is more about politics. It's about the state of the world. Why the shift in tone on the records?
I think it's important to be able to like zoom in and zoom out, to look introspectively and look inside and figure out who you are and where you are as a person. But it, you know, equally, I think it's important to zoom out and look at who we are as a people in the greater picture. I think those are both really important perspectives to come from, and I'm grateful to be able to spend time pondering those things and to put them into music. There's been so much going on in the last several years that, you know, with Oz and the Horizon, you know, it was imperative for me to take a step back and really deal with this question of where are we going, mm-hmm. and where do we want to be, and how will we get to where we want to be?
Do you think that living in Canada makes you more available, or makes you look at your home country of the United States through different eyes?
It's a good question. I would imagine so. You know, I love the community that I live in, and I mean, take it for what it is, but to be totally frank, like I do enjoy driving without concern of being shot. you know, there are some significant differences in that aspect. But I typically travel a lot. So I'm grateful to have the experiences of being able to be in lots of different countries, connecting with lots of different people. And I think that really informs where I'm from and what's happening at home more. You know, even in watching the news, you know, I often will watch the news from other countries just to see what the perspective is. And I think it's healthier overall.
Well, Jake, thank you so much. What a pleasure to speak to you.
Cheers.
That was my interview with E Street Band saxophone player Jake Clements. Check out his most recent solo album, Eyes on the Horizon, wherever you buy fine music.
Keep your eyes on the horizon. There's a safe place we can grow. I'm excited of all the spies.
And listen for his playing on Springsteen's latest record, Letter to You, which is available absolutely everywhere. My thanks to Alan Doyle. Check out his book, All Together Now, A Newfoundlander's Light Tales for Heavy Times, wherever you buy fine books. My thanks to Jake Clements. Most of all, though, as always, my biggest thanks goes to you for listening. I'm Richard Krause. Stay happy, stay safe, and we'll talk again soon.